evening, and I wouldn't play this. Welcome to tonight's seminar on compliance with government benefits programs, presented by the Labor Resource Referral Center in conjunction with the Ocean County Prosecutor's Office. It's gratifying to see so many people come out to get educated about the rules and regulations of government programs. We are fortunate to live in a country that generously provides housing, healthcare, and nutritional assistance to families that are struggling to make ends meet. And I know that many Lakewood residents benefit from these programs. But these programs have detailed rules and regulations, and policies and procedures change regularly. If you are applying for or are already receiving benefits from one of these programs, it is your responsibility to strictly adhere to all of those rules and regulations. The only way to be sure that you are following all the rules and regulations is to educate yourself about them. I feel proud to be a part of a community that takes that responsibility seriously. And I feel honored to have a part in the process of helping people get the knowledge that they are looking for. Tonight, we are fortunate to have with us the Mashiach Shlita, Rabbi Yehuda Jacobs, who has graciously agreed to open our program.
In the civil war in our country, they are built essentially also on seeking the welfare of the citizenry. But the law itself does not directly include the spirit. The spirit of the law is the basis on which the laws are enacted, but the spirit of the law and the law are two separate things. The final version of the law, therefore, is very literal and technically independent of the spirit for which it is built. So this is not quite the same as Talmudic. Now, to confuse these two trends of law arrangement, which can easily happen, can nevertheless lead to some major miscarriages of justice. By miscarriage of justice, I mean not only the miscarriage of civil law, but also the miscarriage of the Talmudic law as well. Because we have the adage, we have to, by the Talmudic law itself, have to adhere to the precepts of civil law. So if someone is not in keeping with the civil law, he's automatically in violation of Talmudic law as well. Let's get that straight. Now, getting down to more to the facts of the matter, result of confusion between Talmudic law, the way you take care of that, and civil law, can easily, maybe inadvertently, but easily lead to misappropriation of funds that are offered by the government, or even possibly illegitimate acceptance of the funds that the government offers. A government could be the state government, could be the federal government. Now, inadvertent as it might be, still a violation of the law. And the fact that really ignorance of the law doesn't really measure up to being an excuse. However, there are times when people are so unknowing that they're unknowing that they're unknowing. They really don't have any idea. But that is at least understandable. That's an understandable thing. Now, that some of these points in civil law, in the acceptance of government aid, have been made clear. So not only It's not only not excusable, it's also not understandable that we shouldn't keep to this, to the left. The rules and regulations, the newest or whatever they were, whether they knew or whether they're not new, but unknown, which are now known and can be known, are available at the offices that look after the civil welfare and the civic welfare of our community. So they're available. And to know the law and be in keeping with the law is really quite simple. Just to make it our business. I'd like to repeat a little anecdote that happened to me about 35 years ago. The government, the federal government, began a program that was called Job 70, a job training program for which the government paid. I was at that time learning with a friend, studying with him, and this friend had some questions about how to go about making use of this program. It wasn't so clear. It wasn't clear that it was legitimate. So I offered to discuss this, at least on the phone, with Yakov Kamenetsky, a world figure in Hawaii. And as I presented the question to him, he was on the phone. And I said the point of my question is, does this idea of my friend comprise a set of government funds? That's my point. This is what I'd like to know. He said very tactfully, discreetly, he said to me, "Oh, you mean about lying? That isn't your question. That's not your question. Your question is about fear." This was the end of the conversation. With this, the conversation was over. Now, this story happened 35 years ago when governmental surveillance wasn't as sharp as it is now. Nowadays, with the tools of surveillance that the government has, trying to attempting to mislead the government is mainly the misleading of oneself. Because I like the facts of life. Thank you for your patience, but I'm sure I haven't told you anything too important to do. I just know it was my duty to say this.
Us tonight in the Ocean County Prosecutor's Office is Mr. Martin Anton. Mr. Anton is a graduate of Swarthmore College and the Wake Forest University School of Law. He practiced law in the private sector for 19 years and in 2002 joined the Prosecutor's Office. Mr. Anton is currently a supervising assistant prosecutor responsible for the Special Investigations Unit, the unit that prosecutes financial crimes and public corruption. Mr. Anton, please.
very much. Thank you for that warm reception. And my thanks to the LRRC. Rabbi, I appreciate your remarks. It's an honor and privilege to stand before you today and have an opportunity to speak to this community. And the first point that I really would like to make is that the prosecutor's office has no interest in looking at people who are in need. If you are in need and you deserve these programs, you should have them. That's not the issue. The issue is the people who may not be in need at all, in fact, are so well off that it's almost inconceivable that they should be applying for public assistance of any kind. And that's the kind of thing that we want to focus on. So I can't give you any specific legal advice, and I just wanted to start with that. Let me just see how this works. So we start out with a disclaimer, just what a lawyer should do, right? And then I have to tell you, I can't give any specific legal advice. That's not what the prosecutor's office is permitted to do. But what I am going to do today is to try to give you an overview of the problem as we see it in the office. And there haven't been a lot of cases, but I suspect that the state of New Jersey will be sending more cases down to our office for prosecution over time. And I kind of have a selfish motive for being here because I really don't want to work that hard. So, to whatever extent I can make you aware of the issues in a general sense and prevent someone from making a mistake, then that's a really good thing. And that's kind of why we're all here today, to prevent somebody from making a mistake and winding up in trouble. To go back then. These are the applications. Let me step back just for a second.
Marty, people in the back can't hear you. Just as loud as you can into the mic.
This is a SNAP application for public assistance. And this is where people can get themselves in the most trouble on this particular form. When they ask you this question about other forms of income, and if you look at this list, it's quite extensive. It's very detailed. There's a lot of things that could qualify as income. And of course, you have to tell them the truth in regard to all of these various things. And I just want to put that up here so you can take a look. Now, this is a lot different than the Family Care application. The Family Care or the Medicaid application is not as extensive, especially this year, and it's changed a bit. To really understand these applications and what qualifies as income and what doesn't qualify as income is something that is best addressed by people at the LRRC or by a private attorney who can help you navigate through these issues. Now I just want to show you the next application and the relevant portion there.
Because
course, the medical bills are very high. But the point is, you're always going to see situations where there's been a fraud, where someone has not reported their income, where that dollar amount is going to take us into the second degree crime range, and that's very serious. The other criminal offenses, tampering with government records. Now, you wouldn't think that filling out a false application would be tampering with anything, but under the definition of the law, it is, because you knowingly make a false entry in, a false alteration of any record, document, or thing belonging to or received by or sent by the government for information or record or required by law to be kept by others for the information of the government. You commit an offense if you alter that for filing. So if you fill out a record that you know is going to be used by the government for its information and you file it, you have committed a crime of tampering with government record. And that's the third difference. And now more recently, as of August 7, 2013, there's a specific crime of Medicaid. And this one is very interesting because it's a third-degree offense, essentially, to willfully obtain benefits under the Medicaid provisions to which a person is not entitled or in a greater amount than they would otherwise be entitled to. And the result of non-imprisonment that is set forth in the sentencing provisions of our criminal code does not apply. In other words, you can have a perfectly clean record. This is a third-degree offense. If you have a clean record and you commit a third-degree offense, a judge will not put you in state prison because the presumption against incarceration applies to third-degree offenses. The legislature said no, not if you commit this crime. So if you commit this crime, even though it's only a third-degree, you're likely to face a New Jersey state prison term. So that's why it's so important to be so careful in what you're doing. And I want to emphasize again, if you're entitled to it, you should have it. And I think that the vast majority of individuals in the community are entirely law-abiding, but there are a few. And you don't want to be in that number. What is Medicaid recipient fraud? Now, this is actually somewhat of a new area to me. I've only had a few cases of Medicaid recipient fraud in the course of my career. Most of the time, it's provider fraud. In other words, a doctor bills for patients that he never saw, or for tests that he never performed, and he bills Medicaid. And we've all heard of those kind of cases. Serious problem. But Medicaid recipient fraud is likewise a serious problem. Misrepresenting household income on benefit applications, not disclosing household composition. An example of that is an unmarried couple with children when the mother applies for Medicaid and doesn't disclose the father's income. Allowing another individual to use your Medicaid card to obtain services. Receiving the benefits in New Jersey when you actually live someplace else. Changing or forging prescriptions, reselling products that came through. Family composition fraud. This is an actual case that happened up in New York that I read about. A single mom with five kids living in Brooklyn with no income on record and struggling to make ends meet sounds like an eligible candidate for government social programs. She signs up for the SNAP and Medicaid for herself and her children and gets government assistance to help her cover her rent. But in reality, she is married. Her husband has an all-cash business which allows her to take in thousands of dollars a month via welfare programs and remain undetected by the government. This is what her lawyer had to say. An attorney at a New York City law firm who represents fraudsters like the person described above says he sees the creme de la creme of Medicaid fraudsters. There are savvy individuals out there. I see clients get married under religious law and not under New York state law. And they wind up scamming the government time and time again. That's our own lawyer. See, you can't play things both ways. A transaction has to be real. It can't be a sham. You can't for some purposes say I'm married, and then for other purposes say, well, but I'm really not. You have to be kind of one or the other. This is another a massive recipient fraud that was perpetrated by a ring down in Florida. And what they did is they had gotten two workers at the public assistance office to help file fraudulent applications, and to help people in filing fraudulent applications. And the ringleader bribed these two women, and he received money from people who wanted to scam the program. So what happened is they go see him. He said, okay, I'll get you on all the programs. You pay me this fee. And by the way, when you go there, you see one of these two ladies, and they'll make sure that they slide all the paperwork through for you. And here he is. He was a former National Hockey League star. I don't know if any of you are hockey fans. Maybe you know. I'm not. But
he was a former National Hockey League star. And
the federal government got him. Now, application fraud is a material misrepresentation or false statement in the application for benefits. And as I said before, it most often involves a false statement as to income. Some fraudsters try to disguise this by creating descriptions or characterizations of money received or through sham transactions. And this is what I specialize in, sham transactions. I'm basically a fraud examiner. I'm a certified fraud examiner. And most of my investigations, no matter what type of crime it is, involves following money through different layers and through different accounts, different corporations, etc. I do a lot of work in money laundering, especially illicit funds that are obtained through criminal activity, obviously, and you have to follow the money. So what's a sham transaction, for example? Well, I don't really want to claim any incomes, for example, so what I do is I set up an LLC. My name's not attached to it in any way. Business income rolls into that LLC. I get a credit card. I go out and use my credit card to pay most of my expenses. And then the credit card gets paid through the LLC. The purpose of that is to obscure the audit trail and make it difficult for the investigator to determine the true source of income. But a good investigator is always going to figure it out because you look at the bottom line. If we look at an individual who, say, is living in a 3,500 square foot house, he has five or six children, and he has a tax return that shows that he makes barely enough money, or just enough money, rather, to get an earned income tax credit, there's a lot of red flags there, because how is he supporting himself? So as an investigator, we would ask ourselves, what is the source of funds, and work backward from there. Okay, so he's got electric bills that have to be paid. How are those electric bills paid? How are the taxes paid? Was he paying in cash? Was he using a credit card? Was he using someone else's bank account? All that sort of thing. And you follow the money ultimately back to the source. So if it's not a real transaction, if it's income that's trying to be disguised as something else, a lot of times that would be income that's being disguised as a gift, because it really is an employment relationship, but it's not being described as an employment relationship. That's what I'm talking about when I say sham transactions. And that's not only important for this, but it's also important when someone starts to scrutinize a tax return, because the IRS lives for this. That's what they do. They don't accept sham transactions. They will always try to find and characterize a transaction for what it really is. Now, that being said, if it really is something legitimate, that shouldn't be a problem for anyone. But if it's not, that's where you run into issues. And so your tax return can't be creative. Some forces try to disguise it by creative descriptions or characterizations of what you see. And this is what I'm getting at. You provide a tax return, which in and of itself is false, now you've subjected yourself to a more serious problem. And how could that possibly be a worthwhile thing to do? If you are a person of means, to get yourself into that kind of trouble just because you wanted to have cheaper insurance or some $2,000 in heating bills being paid or that sort of thing. It just doesn't make any sense. Bottom line is, lying to the government is going to be a crime. It's always going to be a crime, no matter what statute we may decide to use against the perpetrator. It's going to be lying to the government as death by deception, or tampering with government records, or the Medicaid for itself. Okay. And that's one thing I always like to talk about. Something, a concept known as the fraud triangle. In the years that I've been prosecuting big litigation fraud, this has always turned out to be true as far as I can see. The first thing that has to happen for a person to commit a fraud is they have to be under some kind of pressure, a financial need. That's the catalyst that motivates a person to commit fraud or to lie. And what could that be? Well, for many people, it's just that they want to take care of their families. Things are tight. They need money. So that's what happens. That's the catalyst. Others have problems. Some people have drug addictions or gambling problems or some other type of lifestyle issue that puts them in a very difficult situation. They might be facing a foreclosure on their home and they don't know what to do. So there's always a motivating factor for most people to commit fraud. The vast majority of people who commit fraud, there's some type of a financial pressure. The next thing that they need is an opportunity. In other words, for a person to commit a fraud, they have to believe that the likelihood of getting caught is very slim and that it's easy to do and I won't be caught at this and so why shouldn't I? Kind of. And that's where people like myself come into play, try to convince the community at large that, no, that's not the case. There is no opportunity here. That opportunity, that whatever window of opportunity you may have closed there is closed. And we will pursue people who will engage in fraud. And finally is the rationalization, which I always find as the most interesting part of my work. With maybe one or two exceptions, every defendant that we brought into our office who has spoken to us in an interview has usually characterized themselves as a good person. And they'll tell us, I'm really not a bad guy. I'm really a good guy. I always follow the rules. But it was just because of this, that, or the other thing that I stole. And some of the things are bizarre. One lady who stole from her employer, she stole from him because he actually put her desk next to the bathroom. And it was so inconsiderate and disrespectful that he deserved to be stolen from. People have to come up with something to make themselves feel that they're not evil. And the ability of the human mind to do that is truly incredible. To make yourself feel that you're not evil, even when you know that you've been lying and cheating and stealing. And it's just remarkable that people can do that. Now, they'll come in and they'll say, well, I had one lady said, I don't know what happened to me. My gambling addiction just overtook me one day. And she worked for a church and a charitable organization associated with the church. And she said, I kind of had a feeling when I put the church credit card in the slot machine at the Borgata that maybe this wasn't right, but I did it anyway. I'm like, but I'm a good person. And she was telling us what a deeply religious person she was. And you just have to sit there and shake your head and say, what could be going on in this lady's mind that she could, even to the point of actually thinking that it was wrong while she was doing it and still doing it anyway. So the rationalization is the toughest thing to get at. And I think that's probably something that I really can't speak to. That's something that each person has to find themselves. You know, rationalization is like, well, I'm going to do it because everybody else does it. Why shouldn't I get my fair share of the pie? Or I paid plenty of taxes over the years. Why shouldn't I get a piece of the action? You know, rationalizations like that may come to play in this kind of a thing. And I think that in terms of dealing with the rationalizations, programs like this will be asked, because we have community leaders like the rabbi who can address those kind of issues better than I could, far better than I could. And certainly, I deeply respect the religious traditions. I don't understand. I mean, it's just because I'm from a different religious tradition. But those religious traditions should be important in dealing with issues of deception and lying and so forth. And when you think back on that, you have to know that those things are wrong. And that it's just not the right thing to do. But I can't speak to that, to those moral issues, as well as your community leaders can. And I'm sure that they will as they go forward. So the only thing that I can do stand up here and say, we're going to prosecute people who take advantage of the government, that there's not going to be an opportunity to do that, and hopefully take one leg out of this fraud triangle so that it doesn't continue. And really, I know the vast majority of people are honest, the vast majority of people don't do the wrong thing, they live their lives well. But there are some in every group, in every organization, anywhere you go, you're going to find people who are going to take advantage when they think they can get away with it. So that's about all I have. I know that many of you probably have a lot of questions you would like to probably address to me. But as I said before, and here we go again,
I can't give you any legal advice. This was just meant to give you some general guidance.
And now, if you would bear with me, I'll just give you a little snippet of something that doesn't deal with this issue. I don't know if any of you have ever watched that series Breaking Bad with the drug dealers and all that kind of stuff. It's a funny clip. But in this, I want to show you a little clip because this is what to get a sense of what an investigator looks at. This is where the young kid who's a drug dealer meets with his lawyer, Saul, and Saul wants to tell him that he's got to buy a nail salon so he can launder his money. And if you ever meet a lawyer like Saul, find somebody else.
Let me just show you this.
Thank you. You know, you're living in a nice house, you're driving a nice car, you got all kinds of cash money on you, and you're roaming around, and what's going to happen when the tax man takes a look at you? And the kid, I forget his name, he says, oh, he's going to think I'm a drug dealer. And Saul says to him, no, he's not going to think you're a drug dealer. A million times worse, a tax cheat. That's what he's going to think. And so now he's telling him that the way to avoid that, of course, is to buy a cash business, a nail salon, that he can fold his dirty drug money into and launder it. See, he's teaching him how to engage in a sham transaction. But in the end, anyone investigating this is going to figure this out. This is not hard. If you know that you have a person who has illicit cash coming in, you're going to be looking for those kind of connections, because if they have illicit cash coming in, now you're going to want to audit that business. You're going to be looking at things like supplies, payroll, what kind of business they're actually doing in there. And if there's not enough actual business in there to support the income that the business is showing, because the purpose of all this is, with drug dealers anyway, is they want to pay taxes on their money to clean it up. So they want to run it through a business that they can pay taxes on, and now they can actually spend the cash. So, you know, that's what this was all about. It was really funny, believe me, but...
Right attitudes produce right actions. This means that your attitudes are the seeds from which your actions grow. If you have the right attitude about government benefit programs, then you are much more likely to follow the rules and regulations properly and not run afoul of the law. If you don't have the right attitude about government programs, then you are at a much higher risk of doing something that is against the rules and regulations of the programs, and you are much more likely to end up on Marty's list. And I'm not talking about his Hanukkah card list. In the short time that I've gotten to know Marty, he seems to be a really nice guy. But you don't want to be on his bad list. Whenever there is someone that runs afoul of the law and does not comply with the rules and regulations of government programs, you can be virtually certain that they have the wrong attitude about programs. I'll give you a marshal. Has anyone ever had to care for an elderly parent? If you've had to care for an elderly parent, you know that it can be very challenging. Very often, they have health issues, they can be forgetful, they can be irrational. Sometimes they're hard of hearing. Sometimes it's very convenient when they're hard of hearing. Ma, it's time to take your pills. What? It's time to take your pills. Bill? I don't know anybody named Bill. Who's Bill? So it can be time consuming. It can be physically and emotionally draining. And not only do you have to take care of them properly, you have to do it cheerfully and with a smile. If you give them everything they ask for and take care of all their needs, but you do it with a sour face and a grouchy attitude and you're grumpy about it, you have not done your job. So how do you do it? How do you take care of an elderly parent day after day, week after week, and sometimes for years on end? The answer is, it's all about your attitude. If you have an attitude of appreciation and thankfulness for everything they've done for you, then you can do it. If you recognize and acknowledge that you are only here because of your parents, and you recognize and appreciate all that they have done for you, then you can find the time and patience to care for them properly, even when they're elderly. But if you don't have an attitude of appreciation and thankfulness to your parents, then you are going to find it very difficult to take care of them when they are elderly. It will be hard for you to find the time and the patience to take care of them. There will always be something else more important that you have to do. You have a family, you have children, you have other responsibilities. And when you are forced to do things for them, you will be feeling resentful, and it will show. It all depends on your attitude. It's the same way with government programs. I'm going to tell you a story. This is not a true story, but it is based on a true story. And I'm only exaggerating it a little bit, so please indulge. A man came into the office one day and sat down with one of the caseworkers. He asked the caseworker, "What programs can I get onto?" The caseworker asks him, "Why don't you tell me something about your situation? What's your income?" He says, "I don't have any income." "Well, in that case, you're probably eligible for a lot of programs. Food stamps, New Jersey Family Care. But tell me, if you don't have any income, how are you living?" "Oh, that's not a problem. I won a $25 million lottery last year." "But I don't understand something. If you have $25 million, why do you want to bother with government programs?" So the man says, "What does that have to do with anything? I'm entitled to the benefits, right? If I'm entitled to the benefits, why shouldn't I take them?" Government benefit programs are intended to be a safety net for someone going through a difficult time, or for someone that, because of whatever circumstances, cannot manage financially. Your attitude should not be, "The government's giving away money. How much of it can I get? What do I need to do to get some of that money?" If that is your attitude, then you are at risk of cutting corners. And if you're cutting corners, you are at risk of not always telling the whole truth, and then saying things that are not true. And if you are not always telling the whole truth, or you are saying things that are not true, you are at risk of going to jail. Now, I want to emphasize, I am not here to tell you not to take advantage of benefits to which you are entitled. If you are eligible for a benefits program and you have taken counsel with whoever you take counsel, and you have been advised that you should take advantage of a program, then far be it from me to say otherwise. Come to the LRC and we will do whatever we can to get you the benefits to which you are entitled. But please, think about what I'm telling you, about what your attitude should be, and the importance of having the right attitude. Now let's talk about some specifics. Two of the things that cause confusion with government programs are rules and regulations that change. Just when you thought you were getting the hang of the program's rules, they change them on you. And two, the differences between the guidelines of different programs. First, we'll talk about some scenarios that are affected by changes in some of the regulations. Is Shnoka Scheinberg here? Is there anyone who saw here named Shnoka Scheinberg? Okay, I want to introduce you to Shnoka Scheinberg. As far as I know, there is no one in town named Shnoka Scheinberg. Now, Shnoka has a family of five. Meet Mrs. Scheinberg and the Scheinberg children. Now, Shnoka is going to be the star of our show tonight. He's a very versatile fellow, and he's going to play a few different roles. His first role is an unemployed accountant. Until a short while ago, Shnoka was gainfully employed as an accountant. But he was a relatively new employee, and when hard times came along, he was laid off. Now, he's collecting $600 of employment benefits every week. Now, Shnoka would like to apply for New Jersey Family Care. He used to have a good health insurance plan when he had a job, but he can't afford the premiums now that he's not employed. Unemployment benefits are considered unearned income. Before 2014, New Jersey Family Care had a rule about unearned income. Unearned income was treated differently than other income. If you made more than a certain amount of unearned income, you became ineligible for New Jersey Family Care. And that amount was a very low amount. For a family of five, the amount was $131 per week. What this meant was that because of Schmelter's $600 unemployment check, the Scheinberg family could not get New Jersey Family Care. Now, fast forward to 2015. New Jersey Family Care no longer differentiates between unearned income and any other type of income. All that is relevant now is that New Jersey Family Care has a maximum income limit of $754 for a family of five. So if your total income is more than $754 per week, you are not eligible for New Jersey Family Care. If your total income is less than $754 per week, you are eligible. Now, the Scheinbergs can get New Jersey Family Care. The problem is that Shnoga has a cousin Shloim. Now, we all have a cousin Shloim, or a neighbor, or a harusa, or a brother-in-law. Shloim is the kind of guy who always knows everything about everything and is happy to share it with you, whether you're interested or not. The only problem is, this time, Schleimer's experience with New Jersey Family Care is from 3 years ago. And his information is out of date. So when Buzzer Schleimer tells Schmelka about the New Jersey Family Care under an income limit, he's giving Schmelka outdated information. And now Schmelka thinks that his $600 a week unemployment check disqualifies him from the New Jersey Family Care. So he thinks he's faced with only two choices. Either apply for New Jersey Family Care and don't say anything about the unemployment benefits. Not a good idea. Or walk away from a benefits program that he's eligible for and that his family desperately needs. When you are considering applying for government programs, please make sure to get accurate, up-to-date information. Do not rely on President Schleimer. Now, Schnorka's next goal tonight is a budding entrepreneur. After looking for a new job for a while, Schmelka decided to hang out his own shingle and go into business for himself. Now, he's earning a gross income of $3,500 a month. But Schmelka works hard, and he takes clients wherever he can get them. So he travels a lot. He's got $800 per month of travel expenses. That leaves him with a net income of $2,700 per month. And after all, Schnell is an accountant. He understands the difference between gross income and net income. And he figures, with a net income of $2,700 per month, and a family of five, he should be eligible for New Jersey Family Care. Well, you would think that he should be eligible. After all, the New Jersey Family Care maximum monthly income for a family of five is $3,267, and his net income is $2,700. So if our story is unfolding in 2013, Schmelka is in for a nasty surprise. You see, back in 2013, New Jersey Family Care did not consider travel to be a legitimate business expense. So no New Jersey Family Care for the Scheinberg family. As far as New Jersey Family Care is concerned, Schmelka's income is $3,500 a month. And the New Jersey Family Care maximum monthly income is $3,267 per month. But if our story is unfolding in 2015, the Scheinbergs are in luck. Ever since January 2014, there's a thing called modified adjusted gross income, or MAGI. At the risk of oversimplification, what that means is that New Jersey Family Care uses line 37 of Form 1040 of the tax return to determine eligibility. And the IRS considers travel to be a legitimate business expense. So, Schmelka's income is $2,700 and not $3,500, and the Scheinbergs get their New Jersey Family Care. unless, of course, Shmuel goes to Cousin Schleimer for advice and makes his decisions based on the information from 2 years ago. And then Shmuel goes out of line. Shmuel's next call tonight is a return to his roots. In this role, Shmuel is a pillar yudaman with a monthly income of $3,000. He also gets $650 each month from HUD, $300 of food stamps, and he gets New Jersey family care. But Schnauker still finds that he comes up a little short every month. So he figures he'll join a night pile and bring in an additional $200 each month. But naturally, before making any significant financial decisions, Schnauker consults with, you guessed it, Cousin Schleimer. And what did he hear from Cousin Schleimer? I was on HUD, and I wanted to join a night club. So I went into the LRRC, and they told me that HUD doesn't count scholarships when they determine your eligibility. So joining a night club is not a problem for government programs. Well, Cousin Schleimer is partially right. It's true that the additional $200 scholarship income will not affect his eligibility for HUD. But Cousin Schleimer forgot to tell Schnauke that he does need to report the additional $200 income to HUD. He also has to report it to New Jersey Family Care and to food stamps. But even worse, Schmalka doesn't realize that the rules for New Jersey Family Care and food stamps are not the same as for HUD. Scholarship income does not affect your eligibility for HUD. It does affect your eligibility for New Jersey Family Care and for food stamps. So for New Jersey Family Care, it's not as bad, because the Scheinbergs are still eligible for New Jersey Family Care. Their income is $3,200, and the New Jersey Family Care maximum monthly income for a family of five is $3,267. So they squeezed in. But the eligibility for food stamps has different rules. For each additional dollar of income, you lose 30 cents of food stamps. And that means that Schnauke is now getting an additional $200 every month from the night pile. His food stamps benefit should be reduced by $60 every month. So not only did he go wrong by not reporting the additional income, he's also taking $60 of food stamps every month that he's not entitled to. Now, let's add an additional wrinkle. Let's say that Shnomba just got onto the Yeshiva payroll also for Kuddle Chance. Now, that additional $332 of scholarship money just pushes him over the top for New Jersey Family Care. If he doesn't report that additional $532 in monthly income, not only is he taking food stamps that he's not entitled to, he's also taking New Jersey Family Care health insurance that he's not entitled to. And Marty explained before that if you're taking health care insurance that you're not entitled to, all it takes is maybe a baby being born a few weeks early and being in the NICU for a few days, and before you turn around, you're over $75,000 in medical expenses that you got illegitimately and that you were not entitled to. There's also another possibility. Cousin Schlema might have been on New Jersey Family Care and not HUD when he joined the night code. Now in that case, he tells Schnalka, joining a night code is a big problem for government programs. I'm telling you, they count scholarship income as income. Well, Schnalka knows that the New Jersey Family Care maximum monthly income for a family of five is $3,267, and he knows that his monthly income will only be $33,200 even with the night pay. So that's not a problem. But he figures each additional dollar of income means I lose 30 cents of food stamps. Okay, so that's $60. My $200 just went down to $140. And then each additional dollar of income means I lose 30 cents of HUD. So that's another $60. So my $200 just went down to $80. Forget it. I have to figure something else out. This nightclub idea is not going to work. So again, Schmoke is walking away from something that he shouldn't be walking away from because he got bad information. Please do not listen to the cousin Schleimers out there. Please get accurate and reliable information. We will be having a follow-up to tonight's seminar. This Thursday afternoon at 1 o'clock at the LRC office, 2nd Lexington, we're going to have a question and answer session. If you'd like, you can sign up for this session on your way out tonight. There are sign-up sheets outside. If you are shy, you can call the office tomorrow and sign in over the phone. The session will be on a first-come, first-served basis because we can only accommodate a small group at a time. If there's a demand, we'll have additional sessions. And one last point. If you have received an audit notice, please seek legal advice. That is something that we are not equipped to provide at the LRC. We can help you with information. If you have a question about a program, a rule, or a guideline, we can help you with that. But we do not have attorneys on staff, and we cannot provide you with legal advice. If your lawyer has a question, we can answer his questions also. At the LRC, we have a very strict non-discrimination policy. We do not discriminate on the basis of race, religion, or anything else. We even answer questions from defense attorneys. Thank you, and good night.